Hi, this is Brandi Wilson.
And Jessica Smith.
And you're listening to Hashtag Facts Matter. Thanks for joining us.
Happy day after the elections.
Woohoo! We are so glad that is over.
Oh, yeah.
We've been dealing with election BS coming at us for a good 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
People have been screaming, literally screaming at us.
Mostly on the internet.
Thank goodness the election's over. That doesn't mean the hate coming at us is going away. It just means that maybe we can work on our programs for a little instead of all of this crazy political pandering.
Exactly.
So, thanks for joining us.
Mm-hmm. So, the annual National Harm Reduction Conference is a conference put on by the Harm Reduction Coalition. And it is a place for people who work in, volunteer in, live, do all the things related to harm reduction. This year was in New Orleans, Louisiana, which, besides being amazing because New Orleans, is a really important place to have a conference on harm reduction. There were over 2,000 people there this year from all over the U.S., harm reduction organizations and people from rural counties and rural states, from big urban and suburban places, a lot of information shared.
And other countries?
People other from countries. Other countries? Yes, yes. There is an international harm reduction conference, which is in Portugal this coming next year, 2019. But yes, people from all over the world were also at this one, including Spain. I think I saw they had a little booth set up.
They were also in the fashion show.
Yes, yes, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. They started one of the first, the only women-specific harm reduction center in Spain. So that's super neat.
That's pretty amazing. We do have a guest with us today, and he is sort of, he is a puppy that hangs out here every day, all day. He's one of our staffs. His name is Rebel. He's about a 65-pound, beautiful, pitty boy, and he is just the most absurd thing. I think we'll make him, maybe he'll be our cover photo so everybody can see how amazing he is.
He's repping our Health Choice Voice shirt today for HCV testing at Hatcher. So, yes, everyone, welcome Mr. Rebel.
So, bear with us if there's funny noises, because he is a bull in a china shop. He's a puppy in a needle exchange. One of the great things about the conference is Harm Reduction Coalition's value that they put on the knowledge and information and inclusion of people who use drugs. So, every program had... almost every program brought people with them who are consumers or peers or connected in some way to the program and who also use drugs. So that was amazing. And we had 4 people from our group go, 2 peer leaders and then Jessica and I. But we also really encouraged and supported one of our community partners to go, and they did. And it was the most amazing thing to watch another community partner begin to see that, you know, all of the stuff that we're always saying and the way that we're pushing things, that we're not alone and we're not acting in a silo, that this is happening everywhere and that this is a social movement along with other things. And we'll talk about that stuff later too. So we hope you are as excited to talk about the New Orleans conference as we are.
Woohoo! So we're going to spend some time talking about the cool stuff that we learned. We talk a lot, obviously, with our work in our organization, harm reduction related to people who use drugs. But harm reduction is related to a lot of other things, including people who engage in sex work. And because of the recent passing of SESTA and FOSTA, harm reduction and sex work was a big theme this year, and there were a lot of discussions, including like a main plenary discussion. So beyond that one, I went to a couple other ones, one specifically by to folks who work at St. James Infirmary in San Francisco. Really great organization that is run for and by people who engage in sex work. And just in general, I want to say that this conference really centered the voices of women and women of color, and people of color in general, and people who identify as LGBTQIA. So that was really important and amazing to sort of get those perspectives that are often silenced.
Sorry. Puppy trouble.
So the big thing that was discussed about SESTA and FOSTA is that shit don't work. It was created, and these are sort of extensions of laws that have already been in place, and they were created under this idea to prevent sex trafficking. Sex trafficking and sex work are not the same thing. And what these laws essentially force people to kind of do is label themselves as a victim of sex trafficking when that might not be the case. It also takes the power and autonomy away from sex workers. And the thing that it was trying to prevent is it's actually creating. So people who enact sex work no longer have a safe place to find dates. They no longer have, you know, like a listed bad date book that everybody can access. And now the power is going into other people that are trying to get dates for them, and they have less control. I meant to bring my notes with me from this talk and I forgot. I'm sorry. But there was like an absurd percentage of people who went in San Francisco went from being indoors, engaging in sex work indoors, to out on the streets because they lost things like Craigslist, personal ads, and
Backpage. All of the platforms.
Yeah, where sex workers were essentially able to screen the people that they were going to have an exchange with, and now they're not able to do that. So it's really important that before we sort of sign anything or vote on anything, to really have a clear understanding and to get the knowledge and that understanding from people who are actually engaged in the work that this is going to impact the most. Mm-hmm. And that was like another huge sort of overarching theme, is that people who do sex work, people who use drugs, these are people with lived experience. They know what they're fucking talking about. And they can really guide us into some great policy decisions and not things that are going to end up hurting them.
And we see that here. We have seen a very, very large and very forward-moving action to address sex trafficking, which real sex trafficking absolutely is horrific and should absolutely be addressed. But like Jessica was talking about, you know, unintended consequences. Once you know about the consequences, they're no longer unintended. So we're here telling you today about those consequences. And mm-hmm. we see them all the time on the street. You know, there's this large narrative that there are no independent sex workers here in our community. That's just not even true. We see them these folks on a regular basis, and we provide space for them to now, because, you know, they're either have to claim victimhood or go to jail. There's no more, you know, you can get in trouble now. And so we provide space so that people who engage in sex work once a week can come together, talk about safety issues, talk about people who might be taking folks, and, you know, there's some really horrible stories that we have heard because people no longer can vet their clients, which is what those platforms really allowed them to do. And it's putting women in our community, women and men, and all gendered folks that enact sex work, it's putting them in serious grave danger, you know?
Yeah. I just want to say something real quick, too. Sex work, at least in the context that it was talked about at this conference, and I think it's probably a good thing to just go by in general, sex work is an umbrella term for anybody who is engaging in exchanging sex, your body. So that includes prostitution, it includes cam models, it includes stripping, it includes pornography.
Phone sex.
So if you are like vehemently and adamantly against people who exchange sex for money, but you watch a ton of porn or you like to go see strippers
heading down to the tip top for like
I'm sorry, but no, absolutely not. Like, you're being a big fat hypocrite, and if you're gonna support one, you gotta support everybody. These are human beings who are making a living doing one of the oldest jobs in the history of humanity. So give a person a break, man, and help support sound, safe policy. And we are very opposed to sex trafficking, but SESTA and FOSTA is not preventing it. It is actually making it worse.
Jessica is not screwing around today, friends. No. She is not screwing around. She's dropped the F-bomb. She's
sorry,
telling
friends. Woo-hoo! This, all right. Yeah. So another really big conversation that, you know, constantly happened at this conference was about peers and the role that peers have and should have in harm reduction organizations.
And the movement at every level.
And the movement, all of the things. And like Brandy said when we started, there were tons of peers there, including two of our own. These are people who work at the organization, and these peers, ours, all of the other ones, these are people who may or may not still use drugs. And if they are still using drugs, they are still essential to the work being done, to the movement. They are valued, and they should be valued more. That is really what was at the base of all of these conversations, is that peers deserve to be treated like they have so much work experience, aka life experience, and they should be valued and paid accordingly for that.
They are the experts.
They are the experts. They are treated as the experts because that is what they are. And organizations and people and the movement should try really hard to make sure that peers don't just stay in that quote-unquote peer position, looked at as sort of, well, you know, you're not quite hourly, you're not quite an employee, but we really value you as a peer. No, like, real harm reduction work is supposed to make it so that peers can move on to the next level, which for most of them is going to be a paid hourly staff position. And they shouldn't be getting paid less because they don't have an MA or a PhD behind their name. That's ridiculous. They have probably more experience and knowledge than a lot of people running organizations. So it was,
go ahead. Sorry, there's a guy and in his signature, he works in harm reduction. He's a pretty big name. And his title at the bottom of these emails is he's a streetologist.
I like that.
Just want to throw that in.
That's awesome. Yeah. So that was just really interesting because also we've got some pushback about what it means for someone to be a peer and that they have to be sober, they have to have stopped their drug use and have gone through all those motions and now they're aiding people to do the same. Well, peers can still be using drugs and maybe they just have better habits and better ways to take care of themselves now. And if they can get that knowledge across to other people who may be in more chaotic drug use or may not know really how to best work with their health and healthcare providers, if they're able to share that knowledge, then they're making a huge impact. And it doesn't matter if they are still maybe using drugs. Like, that's not the point. The point is that they have knowledge and they've made any sort of positive change in their life that they can then share with other people who might be looking for some advice or who might be struggling and they feel like, oh, well, it's almost like they're not, oh, feeling like someone's over them, right? And saying like, oh, look at me, I'm better than you because I've come this far. It's right. just like, hey, we're both in the situation and I have found these tools that help me do this. Like, do you want to hear about that? Would those tools be useful for you as well?
Like somehow someone, if they aren't using drugs at this current time, that immediately bestows on them social capital mm-hmm. and social status. That's not true.
Yeah.
If
you've been there, if you've lived the life, then you've got some of the same things going on that people might still have going on and you might still have going on, or maybe you've moved past. Either way, you still have that knowledge, you're still that expert, and you can and relay that information to other people. And not only other consumers and people using services, but people who are running the show and making the policy. That's the big thing, is that peers, people who use drugs, need to be included in all steps, in all organizing and policy making and movement building, because they are the experts.
There's a lot of beliefs about that, and there's a lot of old information. And so when people also, I see a lot of times, and I've heard, we've straight up been told, well, that, you know, best practices, when someone tried to tell us that peer best practices means someone who used to use drugs and no longer does. That's not true.
I
maybe 10 years ago. Mm. But that's not true, and that's not what research shows.
There's also best practices for all sorts of different things, right? So best practice for harm reduction may not be the same as best practice for 12-step or AA/NA sort of stuff.
Right.
So we were in a conference with 2,000 other people who were like,
are the experts.
Who are the experts.
We were with the experts.
Who say, yes, peers can be and are many, if not most of the time, people who still use drugs.
And so, in my head, all I can think right now is, oh God, people are going to be like, rah, 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 right? So let's talk for a real quick second before this segment ends about drugs. And what are drugs?
Mm.
Drugs and drugs and drugs, right? We are not talking about, when we say, you know, everyone uses drugs, this is a tagline that, well, it's something I have said and it's something I believe, but it's also something everyone beats me with. Oh my God, did you see she said that? Okay, I'll say it again. Everybody uses drugs in one way, shape, or form or another. So religion lights up the same center in your brain as drugs. So when I say everybody uses drugs, drugs are a thing that change the way your brain is functioning, or it changes your mental state at that time. Praying. Facebook. There's been tons of research showing that those little red tick marks on your Facebook, that you're addicted to those, which also explains a lot of the really absurd trolling we've experienced. Go get your red clicks on, but don't tell me you don't use drugs. Coffee. Coffee's a stimulant. It's a big stimulant. Mm-hmm. Cigarettes.
Alcohol.
Adrenaline. So do you like to drive fast? Do you have road rage? Because I know that shit can be a little addicting. Anyway, kind of on a roll now.
Point is, drugs change the chemistry in your brain. So likely some one habit that you probably have and don't really think about as a drug is a drug in the sense that it is making the same sort of physical change. And again, that's what harm reduction acknowledges, is that different drugs have different inherent dangers and different ways that you curb or reduce those harms. So,
and those dangers come from policy.
Mm-hmm.
The dangers are from policy. We'll have a rant about policy in a coming podcast.
And just lack of education. If you don't know about what you're doing because of prohibition and because of this whole decades and decades worth of just say no.
Which has been shown to not work. Look at the millennials and look at Generation X. It didn't work. It made us worse. Knock it off.
Yes. Good policy, education. End rant.
End rant. We're going to go on to another segment. We might edit some of that out, but probably not. So in this next part of our podcast, I'm going to talk a little bit about a project called Reframe the Blame. And that comes out of a quote unquote union of people who use drugs. It's a national group, but it also, there's an international group of people who use drugs as well. And what this movement, this Reframe the Blame action is it comes out of the National Drug Users Union. And because of the opioid crisis, and once it started hitting white suburban areas and stuff like that, people had some really reactionary feelings towards it. And, you know, a number of years ago, Good Samaritan laws were made, and that was, you know, reduce the penalties around overdose for people who are around. So if someone overdoses, you can call 911 without the fear of arrest or citation for usable small personal amounts of drugs or paraphernalia. That has encouraged people to call 911, which reduces loss of life. It makes it so that people aren't afraid to call in case of overdose. Well, with the opioid crisis recently, more and more communities have started pressing charges for manslaughter if someone overdoses and, you know, say they were using with someone else, and the person calls 911, and because they were using together, or maybe they shared the same bag, you know, they could go in on a bag together, split it, and the person that overdoses, if they overdose and die, and the person who calls 911, there are communities now where this person is being charged with manslaughter and convictions. And what Reframe the Blame does is it's a policy push that started within the Drug Users Union and is becoming a national push. And this was really rolled out on a large scale at the convention. It had started around Overdose Awareness Day. I know that we had one of our peer leaders did a lot of work on informing people about what this is. There's a do not prosecute order. Currently, those don't hold a lot of weight. They're really more a tool for us to start showing that this isn't okay, that we need to allow people to call 911. And if people can't call 911, people will die. And if you're dead, you can't ever find healthier choices. And so all this does is take us back to like 1980, where you're going to have people, you know, overdosing. So someone throws them in a car and throws them out of, you know, out on the sidewalk a block away from the emergency room, hoping someone takes care of them. And that's not because they don't care about their friend. That's because two lives shouldn't be lost in that moment of use. You know, if that person is charged and convicted of homicide, that person's now going to go to prison for nothing other than sharing a bag of dope with their friend. And so that is punitive. It's reactionary. It does nothing, absolutely nothing, because time and time again, research has shown that threats of criminal prosecution do not change behaviors around drug use. They don't. Period. There's no but when, but if, period. They don't. That's what the evidence supports. That's what we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about ways in which people can access treatment. People can access services. We need to have the information around how to, you know, if you're going to use, how do you stay safe? How do you not die? There's the dog. And so Reframe the Blame really tries to get that public message out there that we need to remember this is a public health crisis. This isn't a, we can't do, the criminal injustice system is going to do nothing for us on this except make it worse. Drug addiction doesn't go away just because you're in some handcuffs. It doesn't. There's not I'm kind of on a rant now. Anyway, reframe the blame. And it was started by Jess Tilley and Louise Vincent. And right now they are the co-chairs of the National Drug Users Union. And I'm hoping that in the coming months, we can have one of them on to further explain it. They're amazing. I love them so hard. Louise actually got the Dan Big Award this year at the conference. It was the first year that that award was given out. Dan passed a few months ago, and that award was given to, like, the most badassery change agent that we have. And Louise has just really kicked ass for a very long time. So in this last part, we are going to talk about one of the sessions that I led to, at the Harm Reduction Conference. And that was entitled Rural Leadership in the Time of Safe Consumption Sites. Because when AB 186 was drafted and then came out and then Humboldt was put on, that was Assemblymember Wood was amazing and knows Humboldt's issues and put Humboldt on the Safe Consumption Site bill. There is a large misconception that somehow myself has enough power or influence in any way to get this, to get us included. Man, thanks for thinking of me like that, but that's not real in any way. I don't have enough power to do anything except run our own organization. I didn't do that, and it was obnoxious, and it still is obnoxious that, like, I take the hits for that shit, but thank you, Assemblymember Wood, for putting us on there. And thanks, Senator McGuire, for really supporting, looking into that and, you know, trying to find good ways for us to make it through this most recent surge of the opioid crisis. So, short story long, I held a round table and it brought together some rural leaders working in harm reduction throughout the country. There were people from New York, Arizona, Nevada, California,
New Mexico,
Utah, lots of places, lots of great people. And what we, and this was sort of a hope that I had, was that we would create a network of people living in rural areas doing harm reduction work. Because it's extremely challenging. Not only do we have to fight harder for funding, we have to fight harder for everything because we have, you know, less people, less places looking to fund super fancy pilot projects. We generally have more conservative politics and holy cow, this past 18 months has been quite interesting. And so rural work is just hard. It's really goddamn hard. And so we created this network as a way to share strategies, approaches, ideas, funding resources, and talk about policy and hopefully advocate for good rural policy from people doing rural work. Rebel agrees, if you can't tell.
He says we need more resources.
So at this point, I think we have about 30 people from all over the country, and I'm really excited to see where this goes. It's gotten really great feedback everywhere it's been. So I don't know. We'll see.
We shall see.
So that kind of wraps it up for this month's episode of
Hashtag Facts Matter.
Next month, I don't know if we told you, but next month, we're going to talk about syringe exchange.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, it's so loaded. I don't even know if a half hour will do it justice. But luckily, we have a podcast, so we can talk about it as much or as little as we like. But one of the beautiful things about our podcast is that it is in part funded by the Syringe Access Fund, a funding collaborative of AIDS United, Elton John AIDS Foundation, the H. Van Amerigen Foundation, the Levi Strauss Foundation, and Open Society Foundation. Thank you very much to them. And go get yourself some Levi's. One of my favorite things is when people protest us, that I can see that they're wearing Levi's. It just gives me a smile. And I'm like, please do. Go buy some Levi's. They're awesome. So until next time.
Until next time. Thanks for listening. Please excuse any extra snark, but it is post-election day.
It's been a rough minute. So, yeah, we get a little leeway. We say so. Mm-hmm. Bye.
See ya.